Hey everybody, welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Brownlee. I'm joined tonight by a man who crawled through 500 yards of poo to be here.
Hey,
Doug!
Hey, thanks for having me, everyone. America.
Thanks for crawling through all that poo.
Thanks. It was delicious.
Tonight we're talking about The Shawshank Redemption.
Remember our shows, the first year of our shows, we didn't say the name of the movie.
It was like this weird reveal, and then on one episode where we realized, like, oh, it's the name of the episode, so why are we hiding it?
Right, like, we'll talk about something in a little bit.
now I just put it right up.
Right, that's, I am impressed.
Now I just put it. Welcome to the first episode in the post 500 post-world of this movie.
Yeah, totally.
It's a new... colors are more vivid.
Yes, I can see the music.
you can find our website at fthismovie.net with all of our past episodes and our 500 posts.
Wow. Well, at this point, like 504?
Yeah, 500-something-something. You can like us on Facebook if you haven't already, or if you've unliked us at some point.
If you've unliked us, you're dead to us.
Facebook.com/FThisMovie. Follow us on Twitter.
Twitter.com/FThisMovie.
And you can email us at FThisMoviePodcast@gmail.com.
What about our LinkedIn account?
You can find that on Foursquare, and you can dig it.
You can stumble upon my Friendster.
We're just a couple weeks away from Scary Movie Month, and the weather here in Chicago dropped like 20 or 30 degrees today, and I am crawling out of my skin. I'm so excited.
I'm in a fashionable polo today, and I did not wear a light winter or a spring or fall jacket, and I was this morning, I'm like, I live in Chicago, I can handle this.
Yeah.
When I left work today, I'm like, ooh, it's chilly out.
I'm just so excited to be able to watch scary movies, and there's all these things that I want to watch, but I'm all like Bastion eating the sandwich in Neverending Story, where he's like, not too much.
Don't
still have a long way to go.
Fantastical movies. Now, you're crazy. It's well established on the podcast that you're a little nutso in the noggin. But you will not watch a scary movie. Not to say you won't watch a scary movie outside October, but like especially the lead up to
Scary
Movie
when I'm this
month,
close.
You will not put on,
no.
Let's say, Children of the Corn.
No, but to be fair, I also won't do that in October.
You did that last October, too.
Which is why I'll never do it again.
It was a mistake.
I don't know if you guys have seen that movie. It's not that great.
Why does it have this reputation for being like, when I was a kid, it was like, oh, Children of the Corn, it's kind of scary. It's children. It's creepy.
Yeah, I don't know. I think because people our age saw it, like, in the 80s when they were too young to see it, and there's, like, two dudes in it that are really weird looking, including the guy from Memphis Belle.
There's no weird looking guy. Oh, Courtney Gaines?
Courtney Gaines. You shit on my house's own, Courtney Gaines. Yeah, so I think
Dale Gunner checking in. That's a Courtney Gaines quote from Memphis Belle.
Very good.
It is that, like, you
probably... By the way, if anybody knows Courtney Gaines and wants to get him on the show, fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. We're willing to do a whole Memphis Belle episode.
I will do just a Courtney Gaaines retrospective.
If you have contact with any of the cast members of Memphis Belle, a D.B. Sweeney.
Oh.
A Modine. Is Matthew Modine in that?
Oh, he is the pilot.
That's
what
I thought.
Absolutely.
Everyone looks weirdly the same in that movie.
I'll even take
because
this,
Tate
though.
Donovan is also in it, right?
Yes.
And Tate Donovan and D.B. Sweeney cannot occupy the same space at the same time.
No,
or it's like Ron Silver at the end of Time Cop.
The space-time continuum fabric, blah, 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 nerds.
So anyway, we are shot out of a cannon. We're going to be talking about Shawshank Redemption in a little bit. But first, Douglas.
Yes, sir.
Have you seen anything good lately?
That's my name. Don't wear it. I saw... Yes, I saw for the first time ever.
Ooh, I like where this is going.
In theaters. No, on Blu-ray. I saw Punisher Ghost Protocol. No, Punisher, what's it called? Warzone,
yeah.
Directed by Lexi Alexander.
Yeah. She's all German.
She is all like, please, take your mark. I'm about to call action. And I liked it a lot. No, I didn't. Here's what's interesting is that
I think when you said like a lot, you were just like weirdly on autopilot, and then you realize like, wait, did I just endorse Punisher Warzone?
Here's what's funny about that is that you had actually told me a long time ago that there's a podcast hosted by Paul Scheer called
How Did This Get Made?
Thank you. And Paul Scheer on a very special episode of How Did This Get Made? It was Patton Oswalt, Paul Scheer, another person who I don't know.
Jason Mantzoukas.
And Lexi Alexander, the director of Punisher Warzone. And the whole purpose of this episode was to say, this movie is unbelievable. And Patton Oswalt, and he's a great comedian, and I don't know if I respect his movie choices after this. But no, and I'm not. Anyway, in the podcast, they were saying how it was released at the wrong time, got some weird kind of post-production editing with music and this and that, and it wasn't quite the movie that she set out to make. But still, regardless of all that, it's a gem of an action, violent, crazy movie that everyone, if you like action movies and kind of dark comic book movies, you need to see. And I listened to an hour podcast, and I was sold. I'm like, I got to see this movie. It sounds really interesting. And the stories they told in the podcast and how they how she, the director, specifically talked about the production qualities and aspects and all these things, these choices that she was making that were so crazy. I'm like, this movie has to be great. And I saw the movie, and it's a crazy movie. It's violent, and there's definitely scenes where a person punches through another person's face. But it's also just very, it's kind of boring. Yeah. I thought, I mean, it's, if you not, again, it sounds weird to say like, oh, it's very violent, but also kind of boring, but also we're a little desensitized, and having seen so many movies, it's hard to kind of separate those two things. It's not very funny, and not to say I need my action movies to be hilarious, but I like when there's an awareness and a sense of humor that's not just a bleak, dark viewpoint, and it's just, it's almost like a film project. It's like a young director trying to do cool things with super, super saturation and sure. green lights and red lights and all these things. And there's some cool stuff and some cool imagery, but it kind of left me cold. And I kind of just, halfway through it was like work. And I kind of turned out.
A couple thoughts. I think that the filmmakers thought that the Dominic West performance, which I have not really warmed to.
Dominic West, of course, from The Wire.
Sure.
McNulty. Detective McNulty.
Nice. Thank you, Lieutenant Daniels. And the other dude, Mr. Courtney Stodden, Doug
Hutchinson?
Hutchinson.
Or Hutchison?
I don't remember. I think they thought that those guys supplied the humor. Looney Bin Jim and
Jigsaw.
And I get that that's what they were going for, but again, I'm not crazy about the stylization of particularly Dominic West's performance. It is kind of a boring movie when there's not action going, because the characters are so stiff, and Dash Mihawk or whatever playing like soap isn't very good, and Julie Benz isn't good in anything ever.
Well, is she? Have you seen Boondock Saints 2?
And there's like a kid, and anytime there's like a kid in a comic book movie, or like a kid who tries to like warm the heart of the cold-blooded mercenary, that's never a good plot line. It happened in The Crow. It's happened in a bunch of movies. That's never good. It is crazy violent, and that's the thing that brings me back to the movie, and that's the thing that I can enjoy about it. It really, I mean, apparently it's impossible to get an NC-17 rating for violence.
For violence,
because it is insane. And I will say that there are a few things in the movie that are funny, and I don't know if it's deliberate. I'm going to spoil two things in Punisher Warzone, so I apologize, but there's a dude doing parkour. There's these crazy, like, they're hopped up on, like, crank or meth or something, these Jamaican guys, and they just hop around all over. And one guy is jumping from a building to a building, and then the second guy goes, and halfway across, and there's, like, gifs of this all over the place, halfway across, he gets taken out by a rocket launcher and just explodes in midair. And it's one of the funniest things you'll ever see. And then there's another guy who's, he has, like, all of his limbs hacked off, and Frank Castle finds him, and he says, like, I'm bleeding out. And it's just the funniest thing to me that you don't have any arms or legs anymore. What are you talking about? But again, I don't know if that's deliberate. I think part of the problem is that you saw it, you did those things in the wrong order.
Yeah.
Because I saw the movie, and actually the first time I was not crazy about it, and then I saw it again, and I enjoyed it more. And then listening to the podcast, what is
appreciation for it?
Kind of, or just like, it was interesting to hear her tell stories about.
Yeah, that's always fascinating.
That she was like, no, this, I made the movie that you guys hired me to make. You hired me to make a movie of the Punisher comic book. I sat there and went like frame by frame, and
yeah.
Everything that I was criticized for comes straight from the source material. So I don't understand people's reactions to this movie.
And then there, I think she mentions, which I thought was really interesting.
But she says it all Germany.
It's really obvious that she wanted, I forgot what she wanted for the soundtrack. If it was supposed to be like techno or metal or something like very kind of jarring and intense. And they said, oh no, The Dark Knight or Batman Begins was Dark Knight, like, is so popular that we need to put like an orchestral Christopher Nolan-esque score.
Right.
And it feels generic, and it feels, there's nothing behind it, and it feels empty. I'm also not the, you're the action guy, and I'm not being douchey when I say that. Like, you're the Mr. Heavy Action. You're the guy who knows everything about action movies. Now I'm being a little douchey. I'm obviously not, but I do think if I do watch it, I mean, I also saw it on like a Saturday morning when it was like nice and bright and sunny out, and it just was probably the wrong circumstance to see it in many respects. But it, you know, there are some good things about it, but I was a little underwhelmed.
Yeah, well, yeah, your expectations were kind of high just based on that podcast. You know, I think part of the problem too, and we should probably move on, but
you have that much to say about Shawshank Redemption.
I don't think it's all that possible to make a great movie out of that character that transcends the character. You know what I mean? Like, that might be as good...
Yeah, Thomas Jane.
That might be as good a Punisher movie as we're going to get, because that it reduces it to, like, yeah, he's real serious and he kills people. And that's what the movie is. And so I guess, in that respect, you know, they kind of botched it the first time with Thomas Jane by taking sort of this very real-world approach. And so on the second go around, they're like, well, let's go super comic booky and stylized.
Yeah, I haven't seen the first one, but if that's the case, I complained about Spider-Man in the F This Summer podcast about, like, you can't have it both ways sometimes. Like, if you want to do comic book stuff and put it in the real world, there's only so far you can go.
Yeah.
You need to have some,
I'll probably get hammered for this. I think if the Thomas Jane movie was called something else, it's not that bad. Like, it's just a revenge action movie, like sort of a Death Wish. Okay. I don't think it's that terrible.
Do you own it? I'm looking at your Blu-ray case.
On DVD, yeah, I do.
Oh, I don't watch Blu-ray DVDs anymore.
Just, you're like, what is this 480p? but because they called it The Punisher,
and spin in a circle.
People were expecting something more.
Sure.
Anyway, anything else?
One other thing I saw recently that I'd like to highlight, for a second time, I saw The Prestige.
Oh, sure.
Nolan's, speaking of Christopher Nolan, Christopher Nolan's The Prestige from 2006, 2007? It was after,
It was between Batman Begins and Dark Knight?
Yeah. And I had seen it, just like I think everyone in America, I saw it when it came out or shortly thereafter, around the same time I saw The Illusionist. And I remember thinking to myself at the time, well, The Prestige is really good, and The Illusionist is fine. But whatever. And I don't remember either movie, you know, years pass. And I'm like, which one is the one with, Sherlock Holmes as Robert Downey Jr.? Which one is that? So I put it on because it was just, I just in that mood. And actually, you gave me great advice the other day. We were talking about movies. And Patrick sees everything all day, all the time. He just watches stuff on Netflix. The other day, just a little, I'm going to pull back the curtain for the F This Movie fans. Patrick told me he watched 2000's Vertical Limit. And I'm like, wait a minute.
I said that on a podcast.
Did you really?
I talked about it on a podcast.
Okay, then you already know, F-heads. And I'm thinking, like, you know the movie's going to be bad. And I don't know if this was talked about on the podcast either. But I'm thinking, it's a Mountain Dew commercial. You know it's going to be bad. There's no value.
Did you watch those first 6 minutes?
No.
I forgot to send you the link. Damn it. Somebody posted it in the comments of the Adventureland podcast. But just watch the first 6 minutes. They're on YouTube, everybody.
It's hard for me to just go like, yes, I'm going to watch Vertical Limit and spend the next 90 minutes doing this.
Oh, it's 2 hours.
And then but then you told me this great piece of advice. It's like sometimes when you watch so much stuff, you can't overthink it. Meaning like you're on Netflix, you see something and you have 2 hours to kill, watch it. Like you think to yourself, yeah, I'll get back to watching this movie. Like I've got Barton Fink on my DVR for 3 years. And I think I've even seen it before, but I feel like I need to see it again, but I never feel like I need to see it again.
And if you watch it when you don't feel like seeing it, you won't get everything that you can out of it.
Right.
But one of these days, you're going to be like, I'm in the mood to watch.
And then I'll be like so far away from my DVR. So anyway,
it will happen.
I put The Prestige on and it was good. I'm glad I did it. I liked it a lot. The end is kind of problematic for me, I think for a lot of people. But I think that's kind of the point of the movie, that there's so much in the buildup and the climax that how it's all resolved is always going to be disappointing. So
a lot of people consider that Christopher Nolan's best movie, that's really the movie where he lays out like his whole philosophy about filmmaking.
Well, I think you mentioned this too, that he's obviously obsessed with obsession and very specific themes. But I mean, Inception is so great.
I do love Inception.
And Dark Knight is so great. And The Prestige is kind of a movie that, like, I really have to be in a mood for a period magician piece, you know?
That was the classic example of that thing where you're seeing one movie and then you see a trailer for another movie. Because I literally was sitting waiting for The Illusionist to start. and saw the trailer for The Prestige, and I was like, ah, that's the one I want to see.
What is the, I mean, that's a waste too much time on this.
Honestly, Edward Norton and Paul Giamatti and Jessica Biel are all in it. And
so far you're describing Skelp.
I don't remember that. I remember thinking, like, it was fine, but...
Yeah, that's exactly how I thought, too, but I don't remember anything about it, so I think The Prestige, I'm like...
I vastly prefer
And The Prestige, is really good, it's great. It's I mean, the performances are great, Christian Bale is excellent.
And Scarlett Johansson is in it, you know? And
yeah,
so,
her accent is not nearly as bad as I thought it was going to be when she starts talking.
She's a weird... We can't spend too much time on this, but, like, she's either so great for a part, which... doesn't happen all that often.
It happened,
like,
in Lost in Translation.
Match Point. Those are, like, the two that I can think of where it's like, wow, they really tapped into whatever it is that she does really well.
Right.
Or she feels out of place.
Yeah.
And I feel like most of the time she feels out of place.
I feel like the other characters kind of put themselves in the... And it feels like, oh, she's a transplant from 2006 or 2005 or whatever to, like, whatever.
And she's just wrong for that. She kind of plays a similar part in, like, the Black Dahlia, I think, which, let's be fair, nobody came out of Black Dahlia unscathed, but she just seemed out of place and not that great. I saw two movies that I'll talk about very quickly. The first was a movie called Lockout.
Okay.
That came out earlier this year, I think. One of these crazy French action movies, but this one is like a...
Was it like Haute Tension?
I wish, but no. This was more like a science fiction movie. Guy Pearce is in it. He's called upon to rescue, I think, the president's daughter. It's basically Escape from New York. Maggie Grace is the president's daughter.
Is this French?
Well, it's made by French people, but it's an American movie. I mean, you know, everybody speaks English and everything, but it's like one of these Luc Besson productions.
Okay.
He produces every fourth action movie that comes out. So, the movie's not great. I wanted it to either be better or worse. You know what I mean?
Okay, like, sure.
It's not bad enough or, like, crazy enough to become this transcendent thing, but it's also not that great. It's almost worth watching just for Guy Pearce, and his career has gone a lot of weird directions. I mean, back when, like, L.A. Confidential, I just said that in a weird way, L.A. Confidential and Memento, he was on a roll, and
those were his biggest movies.
And you were going to go see anything that he was in. You're just like, this guy's going to be a fucking movie star. Like, he's awesome. And then he made a lot of weird choices, and sometimes, I haven't seen Lawless, but every time I see the trailer for Lawless, where he, like, doesn't have eyebrows for some reason, and just seems to be really overacting. He was in Prometheus, and it was distracting. So he's not super reliable, I guess is my point, but he's really great in Lockout. He makes the most of every single line delivery, and it's almost worth watching just for him. You know, if you're even on the fence about seeing Lockout, I would say, yeah, see it, because he's enough to be good. But, and the other movie that I watched was a movie called Bachelorette, which...
Oh, yeah, just, it hasn't come out yet, has it?
Well, it's in, like, it's one of these movies that has a limited release. It played at the theater near here for a week. I saw it through video on demand. It's available via video on demand right now,
but only I think through, like, Comcast
probably. I don't know who offers. It's getting bad reviews, which I think is interesting. You know, it immediately gets compared to Bridesmaids.
Well, it can't not. I mean, I saw the trailer. If you are a fan of the site, you obviously have read Watching Trailers with Me. and I remember when I commented on it, like, there's some funny stuff, and it felt like they're capitalizing on Bridesmaids' popularity.
It's, you know,
is that girl in it? What's her name?
The short, obnoxious log line would be like, it's Bridesmaids meets The Hangover.
Yeah, for sure.
Because you have these women who are bridesmaids, but then also sort of this whole celebration of bad behavior, which is in The Hangover. And that's the thing. It's a lot darker than Bridesmaids, because the three leads, Lizzie Kaplan, Kirsten Dunst, and Isla Fisher, are all pretty loathsome people. Mm. And they're doing crazy amounts of, like, hard drugs, and people are doing a lot of cocaine in this movie. Rebel Wilson, is that
Rebel
what you're trying
Wilson,
to think of?
Yeah,
she's the girl getting married. And they're not happy about it, and they're drunk, and they mess up her dress, and they have to fix it overnight because her wedding's in the morning. And if you're a Party Down fan, Adam Scott and Lizzie Kaplan have a little reunion. The cast is really great. I actually like the movie way more than I thought I would. I don't quite understand all the negative reviews it's getting. I think at the end it tries to do some things that it doesn't earn at all. Mm. But for the first at least two-thirds, I actually liked it a lot. And, you know, I'm sure the cast goes a long way.
Sure.
I like all those people. And Lizzie Kaplan has one of the best line deliveries of the year. I won't even give the it's partially her desperation, partially her level of intoxication. They're frantically trying to find a new dress, and she just says, "Is this pretty or is this ugly?" And the way that she means that, like she really doesn't know the answer, it was one of the funniest lines I've heard in a movie this year.
So I should see Lockout.
Correct.
I just spaced the last 5 minutes. I didn't hear anything.
Don't worry about it. You should see Bridesmaids.
Bridesmaids.
Yeah. Let's talk about Shawshank.
Shawshank.
The Shawshank Redemption.
I prefer to call that Rita Wilson in the Shawshank Redemption.
Thank you very much. Rita Wilson, by the way.
Rita Wilson.
Rita Wilson and the Shawshank Redemption.
I'm here all podcast.
Morgan Freeman is going to narrate much of this episode.
Was that a
movie.
Decent... By the way,
I didn't think it was bad.
Never tried a Morgan Freeman impersonation
That wasn't
before,
bad.
And that was my first... I'm sure it was kind of fast.
A little bit, yeah. Fast. He goes a little slower.
Right. I won't do it again.
Oh, come on now. he's constantly just saying, like, Allah loves wondrous variety.
Right.
So, Shawshank came out in 94?
Yes. Which, if we can, let's talk about 94 for a second.
Let's.
It's kind of a great year for movies. I didn't realize it before I did some research, some preparation for the podcast.
Yeah.
That year, you kind of forget that was like an all-star year for a lot of great movies. Even some movies that aren't like Oscar in quotes contenders. Speed came out in 1994.
Yeah, it did. You know?
Pulp Fiction came out in 94.
Yeah, it did.
Quiz Show came out in 94.
It did.
I
remember the five best picture nominees were Quiz Show, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Forrest Gump, Pulp Fiction, and Shawshank.
Yeah. And The Madness of King George.
And also The Madness of King George.
Lion King came out in 94.
For real?
Yeah.
Wow.
So 94 was a pretty, great year for cinema.
Yes. Yeah,
especially
good.
Like this kind of movie, because it seems like a lot of the movies, aside from like Pulp Fiction and Speed and stuff, were like this kind of movie,
right.
Like very
right.
whimsical and fantastic.
Well, this is a kind of a crazy movie that this even got made almost, because you have a first-time director. He had been a screenwriter. Frank Darabont had been a screenwriter of mostly horror movies. He wrote The Blob, and he wrote Nightmare on Elm Street 3. I mean, he had done really just horror movies.
Is that your favorite Nightmare on Elm Street?
No, the first Nightmare on Elm Street would be my favorite. But the remake of the first one, not that stupid old one. It's set in a prison. It's like 2.5 hours long.
Right.
Tim Robbins, not like a huge movie star. I mean, a respected actor, but not a movie star.
No.
Morgan Freeman wasn't even quite Morgan Freeman yet. This
no.
was kind of the movie
right.
where people were like, oh, that guy, he narrates everything. Based on a Stephen King story, title that no one understands. No
right.
one knows what a Shawshank is. Most people don't know what the word redemption means. So... I actually went to see this in 94 at the request of a friend. I was in high school, and I went to like a 9:30 show on a weeknight. I mean, it was so many weird, and I knew nothing about the movie. I was just like, ah, fine. You want to go out? Okay. So I did, and it was one of those that was like, wow, this is a pleasant surprise. This movie's actually very good.
Right.
But not a lot of people saw it in 94.
No.
And then it gets nominated for multiple Oscars.
Winning none.
Right, because Forrest Gump shut everything out.
Yeah.
Except for best original screenplay.
best, special effects go to Speed.
Rightfully so. When that guy's head came off.
Not special effects. Something went to Speed. Best, special effects actually went to Forrest Gump.
Best beheading. Well, I guess that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Best beheading. Best delivery.
Best shoving a guy Dennis Hopper up to the...
Yeah, well, I'm taller. Oh, that's the worst line in Speed. Best line in Speed? I didn't mean to shoot the guy. Okay, so Shawshank, they re-release it after the Oscar nominations come out, and it makes another $10 million, but it's this weird phenomenon where it's not until, like, VHS and subsequently almost round-the-clock showings on, like, AMC and TNT, where the movie catches on to such a degree that I believe it is still in the number one spot on IMDb, voted on by the IMDb users as the best movie ever made.
It's funny because it's number one on that website. And I'm not a member of IMDb. I read some of the comments, and actually some reviews are pretty decent. Like, yeah. People have decent opinions, as I'm sure you'll find in any forum. It shares kind of the number one spot with The Godfather, except Shawshank Redemption has like 200,000 more votes. So in that respect, I think it's solely number one. Godfather's number two. Godfather 2 is number three. Try and figure that out. And I think Pulp Fiction is number four.
Wow.
So it's obviously a very a younger, kind of a little more hip, probably our age type of crowd. It's still up there. And it didn't make a bunch of money. In fact, it was considered a flop. Even its re-release, it didn't. I think it barely...
Yeah, it made basically its budget back.
Right. And then it's still, of course, you know, JB knows way more about this stuff than I do, but that means it doesn't succeed.
Right.
No, it's
right.
Not. But yeah, because I think Ted Turner bought the rights and sold it to himself on TNT and just showed it all the time. And it made a lot more money, obviously. VHS, it was the number one, I think, renter in 95 over Forrest Gump, over because they just had such an influx of copies that people saw it. But it's a weird thing, too. As you pointed out, it's got all these things going against it. I DVR'd it randomly. I'm like, I haven't seen this movie in, 15 years. And I'm like, I feel like I want to watch this movie again because I remember liking it a lot. And so I DVR'd it. It was on our DVR for a couple weeks. And one night I had nothing to watch and my wife and I were sitting around.
Barton,
and
like, Fink. You could have watched Barton Fink.
I could have watched Barton Fink. I'm like, let's watch Shawshank Redemption. And to your point, my wife was like, what about that appeals to me? Like, she had never seen it before. She's like, it's a bunch of men, actors I don't know, it's a period piece, it's in a prison. She was thinking it was going to be a little more violent, and it's, there's some violent scenes to be sure, but it's not nearly as violent. It's more of a charming violence. And it's long as heck, and we watched it, and let's bring us back to you, Patrick.
What were your thoughts on revisiting Shawshank Redemption?
My thoughts were weird. My thoughts were like, this is not nearly as good as I remember it being. However, I was also able to kind of step back and say, my memory of this movie was unfair. And if I look at it through different eyes and different sort of expectations, it's actually a very interesting movie still, in that it's a completely fantastic, I can't even think of the right adjective, like this... it's a fable. It's a made up, it's a fantasy, it's not, I think back, I think I saw it two or three times before I saw it now, obviously in high school, maybe in college once or twice. And at that point I was still a little, I hadn't seen as much stuff as I didn't talk about movies as much as I do now. Trying to examine all
podcasts were not a thing yet.
No, I don't think the iPod was out. The eponymous iPodcast. So I don't think I really examined it. I just kind of, I watched it and thought, oh, that was good. And it feels like it's a good movie. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It kind of has all the elements of like, well, this is an Oscar winning or Oscar caliber type movie. And I was like, yeah, it's good. And I just was like, kind of joined the chorus of people saying, that's a good movie. Let's move on.
Yeah.
And watching it now, I'm like, it's not nearly as good as I remember. There's a lot of hokey, ridiculous scenes.
Yeah.
But if I, again, kind of re-examine it from this perspective of like, oh, it's larger than life. Then I'm able to appreciate it from a different perspective.
It's I think we're negotiating some difficult territory here because people do love this movie so much.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying anything bad about it.
Right.
Aside from some bad scenes.
So I think anything that we say that might be considered critical might be met with some disdain because, like, how dare you guys not love every second of Shawshank Redemption? And we're not even, I'm not even out to, like, I'm going to take this movie down a peg.
No, that's not my intention. Honestly, when I watched it, was like, I bet I'm going to, like, I wanted to show it to my wife. Yeah. And I was like, I'm going to, like, show her, like, a good old movie.
Right.
Old, it's almost 20 years old, I guess. So.
Yeah, just about. But it's just weird to talk about in the context of, like, the biggest, arguably whatever movie site on the internet, like the users have voted this the greatest movie ever made. So this is sort of like the popular choice. I know Vertigo is the critical choice, but Shawshank Redemption is sort of the popular choice of the best movie ever made.
Citizen Toxie, I would say, is up there.
And, And I don't think it's the best movie ever made, but I do want to try and figure out why people do think that, but we'll get back to that. I like the movie. I still like the movie. I think I liked it watching it this time as much as I ever did. I mean, I always thought, like, yeah, that's pretty solid and works, again, when it shouldn't have because of all these things that we talked about going against it. I really like Frank Darabont, even when I don't necessarily love every Frank Darabont movie. He's just one of these guys. He's like Rob Zombie. Like, I really like Rob Zombie. I've never met him. But, like, I just, I like him in interviews. I like the way he, I like what he's trying to do, sure, or whatever. I like him. So I want to support him. And same with Frank Darabont.
You like his movies. Let's clarify
that. Yes. No, I think every movie he makes is perfect.
No, no, no. I'm saying you like Rob Zombie's movies. You're not a fan of Rob Zombie the musician.
Correct. Okay. Yeah, no, I don't really listen
except
to Rob
Zombie. Except the Stern bumpers.
Of course. Well, that, yeah. The American Nightmare. Yes, as a filmmaker or as a guy talking about movies. And same with Frank Darabont. And I don't think Frank Darabont has ever made, like, a straight-up bad movie. But his movies have varying degrees of success. You were talking about how The Shawshank Redemption feels like a good movie.
Yeah.
And it's true. Some of that is the length. Some of that is the narration. Some of it is the subject matter. Some of it is Morgan Freeman being very serious and Tim Robbins looking just sort of wide-eyed all the time, staring off into the distance. And it's sure, like, well, he's very being pensive, thoughtful, right? And so this clearly important things are going on. And there's very on-the-nose narration about, like, oh, it feels like a free man. And it's like, okay, right, yes, you don't need to tell us that. We get it. But okay. I think that the next movie that Frank Darabont made, which was The Green Mile, coasted on exactly what you're talking about.
Sure.
It feels like a good movie. It's another, I think because people love The Shawshank Redemption so sure, much, I think Green Mile coasted a little bit.
Well, and Green Mile is so, it's weirdly similar too. It's like, I get that,
it's
like,
in a prison, it's based on Stephen King.
So much success
it's
based on this.
It's overly long.
Right. And it's a period piece. I mean, it's, right, it's almost like, I mean, it's a very different kind of movie. It tries, yes, to say different things.
Yes.
But I can't imagine, and I know directors kind of stay in their wheelhouse with, like, horror directors typically direct horror, and this, but it's like Frank Darabont for, like, these two movies, it's like, you need to not do this, yeah, you know, because...
Well, but then he makes The Majestic, and he kind of gets smacked down for it, you know, and so then for his next movie, he's only made four movies, he goes back to doing Stephen King.
And that's a great movie.
Yeah, and I actually really like The Majestic.
The Mist we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's, we did a podcast on it. I actually really like The Majestic.
There's some fog in that mist.
The Green Mile is definitely my least favorite Frank Darabont movie. No, yeah, disrespect to the late Michael Clark Duncan.
I remember we saw The Green Mile in the theater, I, yes, think the weekend it opened, and I have not seen it since, but I remember thinking, like, that it just was such, like, fluff and overly,
right,
long,
but again, it presents itself as this
chest,
big, important,
right. Well, it also has Tom length, Hanks, which, you know, right, has this, also brings a weight to him, and Michael,
right,
Clark Duncan, who had a physical presence that was, like,
definitely,
you know,
yeah,
pretty imposing.
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember The Green Mile being like, I thought it was silly too. I thought it was, and it had some silly CGI,
yeah,
had some silly supernatural things, and this is silly and also puffed up.
But it also had Mr. Courtney Stodden, Doug Hutchison, who has come up twice on this podcast and never before. We've done, I don't know, 135 episodes.
If anyone knows,
he's never come up
Doug
twice
Hutchison
in one night.
We'll have him on the show. We'll do a whole retrospective podcast on him and his wife. She can be on our show. We've got like 500 something Twitter followers. I'm sure she's got many more than that.
Anyway, back to Shawshank.
Yes.
Shawshank.
Shawshank.
I have not read the story on which it is based.
You haven't?
No.
Okay.
Because I've never read different seasons.
Do you know how to read, or is it just all, like, moving pictures?
I just like the pictures and the colors and the pudding. I have not read different seasons, although I think three of those four,
yeah,
stories have been turned into movies.
I'm waiting for Breathing Lessons.
Oh, it's gonna happen.
Is that the
now,
fourth movie?
Yeah.
The Body, Apt Pupil, which, by the way, I read different seasons, and I don't remember it.
I remember you being so stoked for, like, Apt Pupil to be made into a movie.
Right.
And then it was, and it was Brian Singer, who we were way into at the time.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, this isn't the movie.
No. And again, I don't remember specifically when I read different seasons, but I was like, oh, I'm not a huge horror book fan. I don't,
yeah,
like reading Stephen King horror stuff, but I like his, you know, what's his pseudonym? What's the, he writes
Richard
under?
Bachman?
Yeah. Is that him? Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. I like the, you know, he's obviously knows what he's doing. And Different Seasons is great, and The Body, which is Stand By Me, and Rita Hayworth at the Shawshank Redemption, and Apt Pupil is, and I like, it's also this, it's a whole story about, like, a Nazi war criminal, and it was just so interesting to me, and I'm like, ah, and the movie came out, and it's Brad Renfro, and he's all like...
Doug has his hands over his chest as though he's laying in a coffin.
Scary Movie Month! Anyway, so I read the book, but you were saying that you hadn't read the book.
I haven't read it. So I just today, like, went on Wikipedia or something and looked at a plot summary of the book.
Okay.
And it really seems like the movie followed the book really closely. I thought for sure, watching it this time, like, this has to be padded, right? I mean, it was a novella. It wasn't even a full novel. And here we have this 2.5-hour movie. I just thought for sure... Darabont added a bunch of stuff.
That's just how dense Bachman is, man.
And it does.
Or is it a Stephen King?
I think it's a Stephen King, okay. But I don't know.
Why does he do that? I don't know.
Well, he hasn't done it in years. He just was Richard Bachman for a short time.
Sort of like his Chris Gaines period?
Exactly. That's exactly right. So it really seems like it followed it pretty closely. I guess my biggest problem with the movie, and again, I like the movie. I think it's really solid. I think it has... good acting. I think the direction is pretty straightforward. Honestly, I was looking to have some problems with some of the plot turns, but it looks like those came out of the book. So I get...
Sure.
Do I fault Darabont for not omitting those and, like, making a movie that's better than the book? Or do I say, no, he only had to work with what he had to work with? The stuff... And if you haven't seen Shawshank Redemption, you do not have cable, but also we're going to be spoiling stuff, so just deal with it. The Gil Bellows character, Tommy, is that his name?
I think so, yeah.
That whole subplot has never worked for me.
It does, it just seems like a subplot of convenience and to wrap up loose ends, and it's the
But is the movie any, or the book, we'll say the movie, just for the sake of argument.
Because I don't remember the book, and we're not talking about
it. Is it any worse off, if we don't, if we aren't specifically told that Andy Dufresne is innocent? That, I mean, that's Tommy's function, is to come in and say, like, no, I know the guy that did it. And Andy Dufresne has this brief moment of, like, oh, I'll be vindicated. And then he realizes there's no hope. He's never getting out.
I think, well, you're asking two questions, right?
Probably. I might be asking six. I don't know what I said.
One of your questions is, do we need this scene in the movie to like the Dufresne character, or to, as an audience, to kind of be with
him? Is it important that we know...
And I
concretely,
think,
that he is innocent.
I think that for you and me, and not to say we're so fucking superior at all, because I'm definitely not, and I know you're kind of not. But no, I think for you and me, no, we don't. We can go with a character that has flaws and has, like, a mixed background. Mixed, by the way, murderous background. I say murderous as being mixed. But I think that for the type of movie this was, it came out October of 94. Like, it was obviously award season bait. It's obviously... a big, larger-than-life, puffed-up, feel-good type Oscar movie. I keep saying puffed up. Absolutely. Because my mom would not totally buy, you know, like, it's kind of audience expectations. And I think that for most audiences, and again, I'm not casting aspersions on any audience out there, but I think that for most audiences, they're fucking idiots.
I don't remember the first time I saw it, which would have been the only 90 minutes in which I wasn't sure whether or not he was innocent or guilty, because after seeing it that first time, now, no matter what, going forward, every time I watch it, I know.
No,
concretely, he didn't do this.
If your question is, would it be kind of a slightly more interesting, I think interesting is the right word, more interesting movie in that we don't know if he's innocent or
but
guilty.
See, but I'm not even advocating that the movie be vague about whether or not he did it. I just think it's played exactly the same way. He is convincing in his innocence, and we could believe him. I don't know. I mean, maybe there's a case to be made that, like, for that ending to work, for his escape to be the victory that it is, we have to know that he was in there 20 years wrongly. Maybe we have to know that, for sure.
Well,
maybe
I think that's almost a psychological question. I mean, yeah. I don't know. And again, I always gravitate towards the vague. I kind of like the open-endedness of things.
Sure.
We've talked about Castaway. I like the ending of Castaway.
But if any part of us suspects that he got away with murder, that ending isn't as successful.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
That's what I think, that's psychologically, yeah. That's why maybe they... But to get back to like the nuts and bolts of the character, the Timmy.
Your mother's right.
Robert Loja. You gotta have. I mean, how else do you, I don't know what you introduce. And obviously, it's a work of pure fiction. So all this stuff. I mean, you could say it's a thing of a plot point of convenience or whatever. This little contrivance that he comes up with to bring this character into whatever. It doesn't feel totally out of the blue to me. I mean, it does feel a little disingenuous, but it doesn't feel like this is crazy. Like why? Because it seems like it. I think he had been there for a long time, and it wasn't just like he shows up and be like, "Hey, by the way, I know you're SMC."
But it's about 5 minutes or less of screen time. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And
yeah.
The movie does handle. I think
if you're talking about if it has it earned it, sure.
I think the movie handles the passage of time pretty well, actually.
Yeah.
But that spot feels so rushed, and honestly. I was only on my way to the bigger point, which is I never liked the way that is wrapped up, which is that he's just murdered in the courtyard by the guard and the warden so that Andy will stay and do taxes.
No, it's a lot more though. If you really, I was thinking about the plot of this movie. Yeah. I don't mean to cut you off.
No, that's at that it. Point. I've always had a problem with like, oh, and then they murder him and we go.
Yeah. The plot of the movie, I didn't realize, I think especially when I was younger, having watched it for the first time in high school, and watching it now even, it's kind of like a weird, like, what is he doing? He's money laundering, obviously,
right.
But I didn't realize how much of the plot is kind of dependent on this weird, very specific knowledge of money laundering and different banks and all these things and how that also facilitates his victory.
Right.
Meaning, like, that not only is he going to be wealthy because he's the made-up person, but also he's going to pin all the books on the warden who ends up, spoiler, killing himself.
In another bad
moment. Actually, that's what I have a bigger problem with, just, like, him murder. Like, I don't think he's just going to shoot himself because cops are outside.
And again, is that, and maybe that's in the story, or maybe it's, you know, I don't know. Sometimes what filmmakers think or what audiences want is this weird, like, I won't say bloodlust, but I mean, honestly, wouldn't him going to prison be sort of a more satisfying end, at least for us in the audience? And maybe Darabont's perspective is, no, this guy's a coward. He has to stay true to his character. And he's going to be a coward and shoot himself in the head. You know, I don't know.
I think that back to the bloodlust thing, I think that absolutely our society, and not to get all like, our society.
Like we're happy because he kills himself, or like, yeah, take that.
But for real, I think that we're such a culture of laws and order, and we have rules, and you follow the rules, and you go to jail, and we can't kill people. You know, we don't put people in prison, we don't punish people, we don't do these horrible things. So to watch a complete work of fiction, to watch a villain who's a pretty despicable character throughout the entire movie blow his head off, it's carnal. It's weirdly satisfying.
I just feel like him going to prison is more sort of poetic justice.
Sure, but I think that maybe that Clancy Brown, what's his last name?
Yeah.
The guard, the chief guard, my point is simply like, I don't think it would have been as satisfying. It could have been poetic, but it's not nearly as satisfying. Speaking of the way ending, obviously Andy Dufresne escapes from prison. And actually, I do like how it all is revealed. I think Frank Darabont it's masterful the way he lays the groundwork and plants the seeds way early on with the rock hammer and all these things and the posters and all, you know, how it all comes to pass and how we find out that how he escapes. It's really fun to watch.
Especially because it never tips itself. You never are sitting there.
Right.
Thinking, oh, he wants that for a different reason. I mean, you're just going along with it. And then when you realize, like, no, this was for this, and this was for this,
right.
And this
it's
was
a 20-year-long process. And again, the way that movie handles time is really good. And it's so much so that even when it's implied in the movie that when Andy Dufresne, the last night he's in the prison before he escapes, he says a lot of ominous, foreboding things to Red and his other friends. And it's implied that he's going to kill himself because it's like he is fucked. Like,
right,
I don't want
to
be here. I'm innocent, blah, blah, blah. And it, actually, I feel like it worked on my wife who saw it. And I don't think there was, to your point, the expectation that, oh no, this is all, he's going to escape. You know, we saw him drop the dirt. No, it's all kind of done in that weird kind of forward flashback type thing. And
right.
I actually, my point is simply, I think that We're not really talking flaws or positives or negatives, but this I thought was masterful, especially for a first-time director to kind of pull this long sequence out, because it's got to be like current time, flashbacks, kind of, you know, future time.
Yeah.
It plays with time a lot, but it's never confusing, and it's really fun.
And again, maybe it's because Frank Darabont had been around movies and working in movies for years before this, but for a first-time director, and again, he took some chances, because I read that, you know, Rob Reiner wanted to make the movie, and Frank Darabont was like, no, I'm going to do this.
They offered him like $2.5 million, like, I would say, make my movie.
But he knew, right, but he knew this was a chance to do something really special, and I think he did. I think for a first-time director, he knows how movies work.
Sure.
Like, this movie is very satisfying, and to your point, I want to get into maybe in a couple minutes some theorizing as to why this movie is
so beloved.
Yeah, the greatest movie ever made. But I think a big part of it is exactly the sequence that you're talking about. I think audiences love a twist.
Sure.
And they really love a twist that's positive and happy. Like, they love Usual Suspects because it's got that great twist. And they love Sixth Sense because it's got that great twist. But there's something kind of bleak about both of those twists,
sure,
without giving away what they are. And this twist is the good guy wins and he tricked us all along.
Yeah.
And gets away with, you know, what he's trying to do. And I think all that works really well. I think the movie starts to feel long shortly after that. I think it goes on for a while after that.
I read something about how I don't remember the book, and let's stop referencing the book, but I know Darabont wanted to end the movie with Red finding the package,
yeah,
meaning like, you know, Andy Dufresne escapes and says, find this buried box, blah, blah, blah. I'll be in Zihuatanejo, Mexico, and find this thing and come see me. The studio insisted he shoot them reuniting, meaning like Andy Dufresne's working on a boat on a beach and Red walks up, and it's just such a, again, and this goes maybe more to what I was saying earlier, like the fantastical fable aspect of it, because you don't really need that. And again, I mentioned before also that I'm kind of a fan of the vagueness of it. I'd almost prefer it be like Morgan Freeman finds the box and looks up and smiles, and it cuts to black. Like, we get
right.
it.
Right, or even as I was watching it this time, and these are complete nitpicks, everybody, so this is not me saying, like, here's what's wrong with Shawshank Redemption.
No, yeah.
But watching it this time, even, I was, even if, okay, so if you're going to go to the beach, if you need to see Morgan Freeman near the ocean to know what a free man feels like.
Morgan Freeman?
That I think the shots, the explicit shots of Tim Robbins working on the boat are totally unnecessary. Can't we see Morgan Freeman walking up the beach to a figure working on a boat? And we know that that's Andy Dufresne. I feel like once we see Andy Dufresne escape, that's the last time we should see him. You know what I mean? Like,
what about in the bank? So you like him seeing him in the bank to get out, withdrawing all the money? I kind of like that. It's kind of part of that whole sequence.
It's almost him telling the story, the legend of Andy Dufresne, as opposed to being caught up with him in real time, and here he is again. You know what I mean? Like, I don't mind the stuff in the bank, I guess.
Okay.
Because he's just retelling this legend. But again, that's a nitpick. But just watching it, I was like, I could do without the shots of Tim Robbins. You know, I just wish there was a different way that this little reunion was handled. But what you're describing is an even better ending, and apparently what Darabont initially wanted anyway.
Well, I don't know if that's what he wanted. I was just kind of theorizing.
He wanted...
You know what's funny?
I'm going to make a miss before joke we about, get... like, Morgan Freeman kills everyone on the bus, and then the army shows up to rescue him.
Well, there's a whole two that... Actually, one of my biggest things is I don't like the Brooks kind of resolution.
Yeah.
And I won't even talk about that too much. Just suffice it to say, there's a character, an old man named Brooks, who gets released. All of a sudden,
James Whitmore? Right?
The story shifts to him.
From them.
The narration shifts from Morgan Freeman to him.
Yeah, that's...
It's a weird... It feels weird to me that you... I mean, the story is... It's tragic. It's a horrible...
And it is interesting thematically in terms of, like, what the movie is sort of about, which is, you know, the effects of incarceration on
right.
these men and their inability to deal with anything but what they know, which is life inside this prison.
Right.
But
I guess, and again, I can't imagine it not being in the movie, and I have no suggestions to make it better. But I remember always thinking, like, him working in the store, gets released, works in the store, and goes and spoiler, hangs himself. It was just, like, tragic for just to, like, make us to really grind it in. And I'm thinking at this point I might have already gotten that, but maybe not. Maybe, I mean, again, they're obviously filmmakers and I'm just a stupid
Because I do think that the movie is sort of about what it means to be free.
Yeah.
That the James Whitmore character, or what was his name?
Brooks.
Brooks. Brooks was here.
Yeah.
Well, that he's never able, that he can't escape. He's never able to be.
Well, he murdered his wife and his daughter, so that's his backstory in the book, by the way.
Okay.
So it's kind of like, well, let's not talk about
that
so much.
Right, and then he's not so lovable with his little bird and his library books. Right.
My point is, though, the narration shift, it was always kind of felt weird to me because it's a style thing, too. It's not just like telling his story. It's also like, well, I worked at the store, and it's like, who's whatever. I want to talk really briefly, before we get to the end of the podcast and talk about why this movie is so beloved, narration in movies.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I've taken a few film classes, as you have too, and as JB teaches film in the Virgin Islands, and I know that narration is kind of perceived by a lot of people, especially respected directors, respected screenwriters, the Donald, what's his name, the guy who wrote?
Robert McKee?
Adaptation.
Charlie Kaufman.
Charlie Kaufman, sorry. Yeah. I was going to say Donald Kaufman, you know, his brother.
Who wrote The Three.
The narration's a crutch. Yeah. The narration is kind of a weak... it's shorthand. It's a way to kind of get your message across without having to convey it. Obviously, the point of movies is to show things and not tell things, and narration flies in the face of that. And it's funny because so much of the great movies have narration. Even this year, Forrest Gump has it. This has it. Apocalypse Now has it. I mean, it's just, there's so much that has an inner monologue that I'm wondering, like, is it just because are we more impressed by movies that don't have it, that tell a story without telling it? Or do we want, as an audience, as, and again, maybe not for you and me and the audience listening to this podcast right now, because we are film fans, but like the general audience, do we want that kind of security and the hand-holding to say that everything's okay?
I just, you know, I think it's bullshit to say that there's a hard and fast rule regarding narration, because you just pointed out there's three movies that use it fairly well, maybe Forrest Gump less so, but okay, whatever. I don't have a problem with most of the narration in Shawshank Redemption.
I actually don't either. But I'm saying, I think narration, again, I don't think there's a right or wrong, and obviously some movies use it well, but I do know that there's a stigma attached to it.
Oh, for sure, yeah. But I think that's kind of bullshit, because it's all in how you use it. It's not whether or not you do use it. You know, I don't think that should be the question. I think it's, if you're going to use it, make sure you're doing it right. You know, look at Blade Runner, which has it, and it's like, ah, this is jarring and bad, and they need to get it out, and they did. Whereas I don't think Shawshank Redemption works as well without it, but I also think part of that reason is, and watching it this time again, I was trying to decide, like, is this a flaw of the movie, or is this by design, that the Tim Robbins character, that Andy Dufresne, I guess he's not really supposed to be, like, a fully realized character. He's just this weird symbol. He's this empty vessel into which Red can, like, pour what he thinks about him. But again, we're told over and over that they become such good friends. But we know so little about him, except that he's innocent. You know, I mean, we know, like, that he's good with numbers. We know that he's innocent. We know...
Well, it's even talked about, too, that I think he even explains that his aloofness, his distance is why his marriage fell apart. And it's a character flaw, and it also helps the plot.
But the movie still functions because it's Red's story about Andy Dufresne. It's not Andy Dufresne's story.
Until it's about Brooks, and which is Brooks' story about himself.
So I don't have a problem with it, but watching it this time, I was like, oh, I don't know. Is the fact that the Tim Robbins character feels so... not even underdeveloped, just cryptic maybe? I don't know. Is that a problem with the movie? If we knew him better, would it be even stronger? But not necessarily.
I heard that the Carl Reiner version, or what he was proposing, was going to be...
Rob Reiner version?
Yeah, not Carl. Carl Reiner was going to make a totally different version.
A hilarious version.
Rob Reiner's version was going to have Harrison Ford and Tom Cruise. That's what he was wanting. And it's like...
Eesh.
And something you said earlier, too, about Morgan Freeman. It's funny. It's hard to remember. Kind of like... when you watch an old movie that kind of set, that reinvented everything. Yeah. Like Halloween, we just talked about that offline, about how that movie, when it first came out, I think JB specifically mentioned, like, it was insane. We had never seen anything like this before. And this is a, that's a, I'm making a leap right now, but Morgan Freeman in 94 was not Morgan Freeman in 2012. He was not the cartoon character he became. So his performance had some gravitas.
As Kiefer Sutherland would say.
That's right.
Why do you think people love this movie so much? Why has this movie endured?
I think that
Four Weddings and a Funeral did not.
We've talked about this before on the podcast, especially around award season time and our favorite movies of the year. I think some people out there like things because they think they should.
Okay.
I know we talked about this. Let me just to expand on the whole thing about Oscar stuff and best movies ever. I think a lot of people, especially at every year-end list, and I know we make a very concerted effort to try to not just do the 10 most popular Oscar bait type movies at the end of every year. So obviously you, me, JB, everyone in F This Movie always tries to pick our personal favorites and we try to justify it. And sometimes the justification is like, Iron Man 2 is not so bad. And it's like, that's a horrible mistake. Don't listen to Best of 2010.
I almost put We Bought a Zoo on last year. I was close. I would regret that now.
But here's the funny thing. Like, if you put We Bought a Zoo on Best of 2011, it's a questionable kind of choice.
Yeah.
But it's a choice that is like has a reason and you could defend it and kind of explain why.
Right, but you also don't want to be Armand White, who just wrote an entire article about how Paul W.S. Anderson is a vastly superior filmmaker to Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, of course. But no, of course, we're not...
See, it's the opposite of what's true. That's what makes it interesting.
But we never try to be contrarian again. I like it so much more when you have your personal
choices. Honest,
yeah. Like, I love really bad movies sometimes, and I love really great movies, and sometimes really great movies elude me. You know, I don't get a lot of, like, even some of the best movies ever. Like, they're fine. Like, I like them fine, whatever. I think that Shawshank kind of fits in that weird sweet spot with a lot of people where it feels good. It is respected, even by, like, critics and douchey film people. And I guess those are the two things.
Yeah.
Because it feels good and because it's like, oh, I can actually like this movie that I'm supposed to like, I'll even like it more because I feel like I'm part of the club.
Yeah, I almost feel like, and I'm not saying this just to contradict you, like, that the groundswell of support around Shawshank Redemption happened almost in a vacuum. That, like, I think when people started to embrace it on video or on cable, that they weren't even necessarily aware of any critical reputation. Do you know what I mean? And maybe it's just because it's a movie that feels important or whatever, but I don't know that they were measuring their response against, like, oh, and critics like this too, so it's okay to like it.
Yeah, no, I don't... just to clarify, I don't think that people were, like, reading the Ebert review or whatever and saying, oh, Dana White or so-and-so said I should like this and I should like this. I'm not saying that necessarily, but it feels important and therefore... And because it is kind of like... And I think part of it, too, is because a lot of people had the same reaction that you had and that I might have had, where you kind of weren't expecting much, and you watch it, and you're like, well, fuck me, that was some fun. That was actually a really, like, fulfilling, feel-good movie. And a lot of important movies, in quotes, don't have happy endings sometimes. Sometimes the most important movies are, like, kind of downers and bummers, which is why, like, you know, insulated, nerdy film people like it so much because we're hermits and, you know.
And we did accuse the movie of being a little corny at times.
Oh, it's super corny.
But see, I don't know that I would say it's super corny.
You're wrong. It is.
Because I think you're right. I think it's absolutely a feel-good movie. I think it has this happy ending. But I think it's also sort of this measured happiness because you also have to realize, oh, this guy spent 20 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit.
And we haven't talked about all the rape.
Brutally raped a bunch of times. Oh, this old man is freed from prison and kills himself, and this kid is murdered by guards. I mean, there's like some dark shit happens in the movie, and the movie doesn't necessarily try and be all like gritty about it. You know what I mean? It's not this edgy prison drama, which I think also helps. I think the fact that it's sort of this period movie, I think that always helps because it's always like this weird, you're almost watching a memory. You're not, you're not in it as much as you would be like.
Are you in it? According to Garden State,
you're in it
right now,
aren't you?
I think part of it too is because it takes place over 20 years.
Yeah.
That you can't really dwell on the grittiness of the horribleness of all these things because you have to move along.
Right.
A year later, the memory of the rape is over. The bruises have healed, you know? But yeah, to your point, it is really violent. I mean, there's a weird, like, the first third has a lot of the horrible, like, rape stuff and
the
sisters.
The guy, the dude from the table at Kissing a Fool, Is murdered very early on by the guards.
Yeah.
And
the dude from the guy from Kissing a Fool, that's, oh my God, the one Bonnie Hunt's telling the story to.
Yeah.
Oh.
Never rat on your friends.
That is so great. But here's the thing. I don't think that those two things are mutually exclusive. I think that you can have grittiness, but you could also be super effing corny. Like when Brooks feeds
the Which is sort of, I guess, the line that this movie walks.
Even,
you know?
Even Brooks's death is kind of corny. Like,
sure,
it's
sure, sure.
Weirdly,
well,
like,
the pan up to Brooks was here, and...
The pan up, and also just the, even the hanging seems, to your what you said earlier, it's poetic. You know,
yeah,
it's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's a poetic right. end that is kind of like, well, how else would he have, like...
But a lot of that is Stephen King, too. Stephen King loves that shit.
Yeah.
Loves it.
So I think it does both, and I don't think it has to do... But it is, yeah, it's walking a very specific kind of path.
It's so weird, because watching it, I was like... finding more problems than I remembered having, but it had been a while since I'd seen it, and I felt like, oh, maybe it's not quite as good as I remember, or as a lot of people maybe seem to think, but now as we're talking about it, I'm just like, it's really good, it's
yeah.
really solid, like, well, I'm just thinking about this combination of, like, the period and the setting and Stephen King, and maybe because
right
it's
elements.
Fall, and I'm like, it feels like such a fall movie to me, you know, the movie...
It feels like a movie you have, like, a fireplace on, and it's, like, night on a Saturday, and you have nowhere to be, and it's like,
right.
I'm going to watch 2.5 hours of Shawshank
Redemption. For me, it's more of a Sunday afternoon, like, gray sky movie.
Well, you're wrong.
Listen, we can
agree. Let's have this discussion right now.
I also think that I think it could have been a mistake for the movie to get bogged down in 2 hours or 2 hours and 15 minutes of Prison is the Worst, and then... to try and reward us at the end. And there's a movie, The Pursuit of Happiness. That's the one that I always think of. An hour and 55 minutes of...
God, I remember nothing about that movie.
There's a moment... I might have talked
this
about this on the podcast before. Yeah.
It was spelled wrong, happiness.
Trying to find a job, and he's taking care of his son.
And it's like a horrible, like, no, you should not do
every
this to
your son. Single bad thing that can happen to a person happens to Will Smith. I mean, he's just beaten down by life over and over and over again to the point where... they finally are, like, sleeping in, like, a public bathroom or something, and
right.
the light above them goes out, and it's like, what else could go wrong? And I think I turned to Erica at that point and said, like, I wish it would start raining indoors, like, just on him.
But it's pee instead.
And spoilers for The Pursuit of Happiness, it all works out. And it's like, congratulations, Will Smith, you got the job. Big smile, credits. And it's like, you cannot put us through 2 hours
right.
of life is the worst. It is so hard. And then expect us to walk out feeling uplifted because he didn't give up and he got the job.
Because now he has a 401k.
Shawshank could have been that, I think, because the end is so satisfying that it could have given us 2 hours of like, oh, everything's the worst. But whether it's Stephen King or whether it's Frank Darabont, very smart in giving, there's these little victories
yeah.
throughout. And so you're never bogged down and just like, oh my God, everything's so horrible. Because you get the scene on the roof where they all drink beer, or you get the scene where he plays the record, or you just get scenes where they have made this little family for themselves.
Yes, for sure.
And that they sort of forget where they are and why, and the fact that they are incarcerated, you know.
Well, it's all they know, too, and I think we actually kind of become part of that family, too,
right.
to some extent, because
right.
it's like, well, if this is all they know... and they're fine with it, I'm fine with it too,
right.
and this is now the world I'm going to occupy for the next 2 hours.
The only issue that I take is that every time we get one of those moments, we have to have Red saying, like, we were free men, we forgot what it was like to
That's
be
actually a way better Morgan Freeman impersonation.
And he just has to keep reminding us that, like, for a little while, we remember what it was like to be free.
I read somewhere that Stephen King based the book or the novella on... like every prison movie he watched when he was a kid.
Okay.
Like that this is like his
I haven't seen very many prison movies.
I don't know what he was talking
about.
I saw
Let's Go to Prison.
That's an awful movie.
And I saw Caged Heat.
That's a sexy movie. But he said it is like it's more like when he's a kid watching movies that maybe took place in prison and all these different kind of divergent elements and all these characters and stuff. And it's a memory, again.
Right.
And I'm going to write a book about this memory. And I think that also lends to this, and again, it's my kind of realization, my epiphany, where I'm like, I cannot like certain parts of the movie, and I can kind of be a little more mature and a little more, I'm on to you, Shawshank Redemption. But still, it works for me, and I mentioned this way early on, because of the fantastical nature, I think, based on the Stephen King revelation, that like it is this kind of hodgepodge, a pastiche, if you will, of all these elements, and because of that, it becomes like a fantasy.
Right. So why does Shawshank work so well, and at least to you and me, Green Mile does not?
I don't remember enough about Green Mile. Okay. I remember just
I don't totally either, but I just feel like they're so similar in so many ways. And obviously, sure. Green Mile introduces a supernatural element that's not present in Shawshank, but I don't think that's the movie's undoing.
I think it was like, I'm John Coffey, like coffee, except spelled different.
Spelled like the Pam Grier movie, he should have said. That's right. What he should have said, but he didn't. And now look where he is. He passed away. He's not with us. He's no longer with us.
He's listening, though, right now. I'm sure of it.
Right next to Brent Renfro. Oh. They're talking about us.
I think there's someone dead in every Stephen King novella adaptation.
River Phoenix is in Stand By Me.
There you go.
Holy shit.
River and some major character, like Major, River Phoenix, John Coffey. Wait, who's in Shawshank?
Oh, no one. Why do we... Brad Renfro?
I didn't Brooks. Look. Brooks is dead. James Whitmore.
He is. Yeah. James Whitmore is dead.
Or Whitmore. Got it right.
I also like, going back to what I like about Frank Darabont, I like that he reuses a lot of the same actors.
Yeah.
And I don't remember the guy's name.
I like when any director kind of finds a character actor. I think Joe Dante does it all the time.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Just like, I like you, you're going to be in my movie.
And Paul Thomas Anderson has his little repertory company that he doesn't use as much anymore. But for a little while, you'd always see the same people pop up.
Melora
Walters shows up. And Frank Darabont definitely has that. I don't remember the actor's name, but he plays the prosecuting attorney in the opening scene.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And he would go on to be Dale on The Walking Dead. He has a big part in The Majestic. I mean, he shows up in a lot of stuff. And it's just great to see, like, oh, there's William Sadler. He's in every Frank Darabont movie, you know.
Yeah.
And he's in Demon Knight.
I like Demon Knight.
Yeah.
Get that pussy off the table!
Demon Knight reference.
This is the last thing I say on the podcast.
Ever?
I am going the way of Michael Clark Duncan. Get that pussy off the table. No, that won't be the last thing.
I know there's way more we can say about Shawshank Redemption, but we're not going to. Like, we're probably going to stop. But I'm sure there's people who really love the movie who are like, you guys did 15 minutes on Punisher Warzone. Spend a little more time on Shawshank. But I don't know. It's really good. I want to understand its reputation a little bit more. But at the same time, maybe there's not much more to understand. Maybe it's just like...
I think we cracked the code. And I'm not trying to sound like I'm not patting myself on the back. But I think that, like, it's not such a mystery to me as to why this movie is beloved.
Yeah.
And even if I can't quite vocalize it or verbalize it, like, I think it makes sense. Like, it's a movie I can show to any adult. And I say adult because there's obviously some...
A lot of language.
Some stuff that I wouldn't... Or rape, you know, ass rape.
Not the sexy kind.
But I would show this to any, like, my even people that I know don't necessarily like movies, like, they like this movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think that is a weird kind of, maybe I'm using the word to define itself, but...
No, I think you're absolutely right. I totally understand why it's beloved. I guess I just wanted to understand why it's beloved more than anything else, but who knows?
I think part of it, too, is because some people that vote haven't seen Godfather, and some people that vote, like, were really turned off by Pulp Fiction, you know? Like, I know people that... Pulp Fiction's great. There's no denying it. Fuck you if you disagree with me.
Right.
But people don't like it.
But what a weird year of the Academy Award race of, like, 94 is. Because you have, you know, Quiz Show and Shawshank, I think, sort of belong in the same category, which is sort of this very classical
nostalgic
kind of storytelling. But also, I think, not, you know, just corny awards bait. Like, I think both of them have an honesty to them or an edge to them. Shawshank is not really edgy, but it's not all dull.
Shawshank is populist, though. Shawshank is Williams, Jennings, Bryan. It's
so is Quiz Show to an extent, but I think they're both smart, maybe.
Yeah.
And Four Weddings and a Funeral, I don't know.
I don't remember that movie at all.
Honestly. I don't, and I'm not really a fan, but I think that was like, as Miramax was really starting to make its push, I think that's a Miramax movie. But really, you know, it comes down to Forrest Gump versus
Pulp Fiction.
Right. And it's like...
Those are two opposite
kind of
ions, and they're repelling each other. but I do think, you know, just to hit this again, you know, Pulp Fiction, people don't like it. I don't know one person that does, like, that people probably are like, eh, Shawshank's fine.
Yeah.
But I don't think any person out there is like, oh, I can't stand that movie.
I'm sure that person exists. With any movie, that person exists.
That person will comment tomorrow.
They may very well. But, yeah, it's good. It's really good. I don't know.
Yeah. Like, it's a fun movie.
Totally watchable.
Fun. It's not fun.
It's fun. No, the some scenes are fun. Come on.
It's also because it is that kind of throwback. It feels comforting.
Yeah,
in a way,
definitely
way too.
Well, again, which is weird. We got to wrap
about
up,
prison.
But it
we're
is
just repeating ourselves.
Horrible
now.
Things happen, but that's the thing. It's like he found this tone because horrible things happen. People are murdered and people are raped, and a man is held for 20 years when he's innocent. But it feels
comfort.
Yeah. It's this weird, comfortable vibe. Like,
right.
Oh, Shawshank, it's great to be back at you. No, it isn't! It's a horrible place.
It's the worst place ever!
I'm turning into Seinfeld. Anyway, thank you guys very much for listening. Remember, you can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you, I think, for one more week, and then it's Scary Movie Month. Oh,
strap
shit.
Strap on your horror.
I can't wait. Talk to you guys soon.
How can you be so obtuse?